Side 4, The Tommyknockers by Stephen King. Continuing on page 93. The sun and the clouds together brought another childhood rhyme to mind. Red sky at night, sailor's delight. Red sky at morning, sailor take warning. Gar didn't know about red sky at morning or at night, but he knew those delicate scales of cloud were a reliable harbinger of rain. Too goddamn many rhymes for a man's last morning on Earth, he thought irritably. And then, I'm going to wake you up, Bobby. Going to wake you up, but I promise you I'll never do it again. But there was no Bobby to wake up. The phone rang, that was all. Rang. And rang. And rang. Your party doesn't answer, the operator told him, just in case he was deaf or had maybe forgotten what he was doing for a few seconds and had been holding the phone against his asshole instead of his ear. Would you like to try again later? Yeah, maybe, but it'd have to be by Ouija board, Eileen. Okay, he said. You have a good one. Thank you, guard. He pulled the phone away from his ear as if it had bitten him and stared at it. For a moment she had sounded so much like Bobby. So goddamn much. He put the phone back and got as far as, why did you? Before realizing that cheerful Eileen had clicked off. Eileen. Eileen. Not Bobby. But she had called him guard. Bobby was the only one who... No, change that, he'd said. Tell her it's guard calling. There. Perfectly reasonable explanation. Then why didn't it seem that way? He hung up slowly. He stood at the side of the mobile station in wet socks and shrunken pants and untucked shirt, his shadow long and long. A phalanx of motorcycles went by on Route 1, headed for Maine.
Bobby's in trouble. Will you please just let that go? It's bullshit, as Bobby herself would say. Somebody tell you the only holiday you could go home for was Christmas? She went back to Utica for the glorious Fourth, that's all.
Yeah, sure. Bobby was as likely to go back to Utica for the Fourth as Guard was to apply as an intern at the new Bay State nuclear plant. Sister Anne would probably celebrate the holiday by ramming a few M-80s up Bobby's coos and lighting them.
Well, maybe she got invited to be parade marshal, or sheriff marshal, ha-ha, in one of those cow towns she's always writing about. Deadwood, Abilene, Dodge City, someplace like that. You did what you could, now finish what you started.
His mind made no effort to argue. He could have dealt with that. Instead, it only reiterated its original thesis.
Bobby's in trouble. Just an excuse, you chicken shit bastard.
He didn't think so. Intuition was solidifying into certainty. And whether it was bullshit or not, that voice continued to insist that Bobby was in a jam. Until he knew one way or the other for sure, he supposed he could table his personal business. As he had told himself not long ago, the ocean wasn't going anywhere. Maybe the Tommyknockers got her, he said out loud, and then laughed. A scared, husky little laugh. He was going crazy, all right. Chapter 7. Gardner Arrives. 1.
He's staring down at his skis, plain brown wood strips racing over the snow. He started looking down just to make sure he was keeping the skis nice and parallel, not wanting to look like a snow bunny with no business here after all. Now he's almost hypnotized by the liquid speed of his skis, by the crystal flicker of snow passing in a steady white strip, 6 inches wide, between the skis. He doesn't realize his state of semi-hypnosis until Anne-Marie screams, "Guard, watch out! Watch out!" It's like being roused from a light doze. That's when he realizes he's been in a semi-trance, that he has been looking down at that shiny, flowing strip far too long. Anne-Marie screams, "Stem Christie, guard, Stem Christie!" She screams again, and this time, is she telling him to fall down? Just fall down? Christ, you could break a leg that way. In these last few seconds before the crunching impact, he still can't comprehend how things got serious so fast. He has somehow managed to drift far off to the left side of the trail, Pines and spruces, their blue-gray branches heavy with snow, are blurring past less than 3 yards from him. A rock poking out of the snow blips by. His left ski has missed it by inches. He realizes with cold horror that he has lost all control, has forgotten everything Anne-Marie has taught him, maneuvers that seem so easy on the kiddie slopes. And now he's going. What? 20 miles an hour? 30? 40? Cold air cuts against his face, and he sees the line of trees at the edge of the straight arrow trail getting ever closer. His own straight arrow has become a mild diagonal. Mild, but enough to be deadly just the same. He sees his path will soon take him off the trail completely, and then he will stop. You bet. Then he will stop very quickly. She shrieks again, and he thinks, Stem Christie? Did she really say that? I can't even snowplow for beans, and she wants me to do a Stem Christie? He tries to turn right, but his skis remain stubbornly on course. Now he can see the tree he'll hit. A big, hoary old pine. A red stripe has been painted around its gnarly trunk. A wholly unnecessary danger signal. He tries again to turn, but he's forgotten how to do it. The tree swells, seeming to rush toward him while he himself remains still. He can see jagged knobs, splintery, groping butts of branches on which he may impale himself. He can see nicks in the old bark. He can see drifts where the red paint is run. Anne-Marie shrieks again, and he's aware he himself is screaming. Two. Mister? Mister, are you all right? Gardner sat up suddenly, startled, expecting to pay for the movement with a whacking thud of pain through his head. There was none. He experienced a moment of nauseous vertigo that might have come from hunger. But his head was clear. The headache had passed in its sudden way while he slept, perhaps even while he was dreaming of his accident. I'm okay, he said, looking around. His head thudded now, but against a drum. A girl in cut-off denim jeans laughed. You're supposed to use sticks on those, man, not your head. You were mumbling in your sleep. He saw he was in a van, and now everything fell into place.
Was I?
Yeah. Not good, mumbled.
It wasn't a good dream,
Gardner said. Have a hit off this, the girl said and handed him a joint. The roach clip it was in, he saw, was a golden oldie. Richard Nixon in a blue suit, fingers thrust up in the characteristic double V gesture that probably not even the oldest of the 5 other people in this van remembered. Guaranteed to cure all bad dreams. The girl added solemnly.
That's what they told me about the booze, Lady Day. But sometimes they lie. Take it from me, sometimes they lie.
He took a small hit off the joint for politeness sake and felt his head begin to swim almost at once. He handed it back to the girl who was sitting against the van sliding door and said,
I'd rather have something to eat.
Got a box of crackers, the driver said and handed it back. We ate everything else. Beaver even ate the fucking prune. Sorry.
Beaver'd eat anything, the girl in the cutoff said. The kid in the van shotgun seat looked back. He was a plump boy with a wide, pleasant face.
Untrue, he said. Untrue. I'd never eat my mother.
At that, they were all laughing wildly, Gardner included. When he was able, he said,
The crackers are fine. Really.
And they were. He ate slowly at first, tentatively, monitoring his works closely for signs of rebellion. There were none, and he began to eat faster and faster, until he was gobbling the crackers in big handfuls, his stomach snarling and yapping. When had he last eaten? He didn't know. It was lost in the blackout. He did know from previous experience that he never ate much when he was busy trying to drink up the world, and a lot of what he tried to eat either ended up in his lap or ran down his shirt. That made him think of the big greasy pizza he had eaten, tried to eat, Thanksgiving evening 1980, the night he had shot Nora through the cheeks.
Or you could have severed one or both optic nerves,
Nora's lawyer suddenly shouted furiously at him inside his head.
Partial or total blindness, paralysis, death. All that bullet had to do was chip one tooth to go flying off in any direction, any damn direction at all, just one. And don't sit there and try any bullshit like how you didn't mean to kill her, either. You shoot a person in the head, what else are you trying to do? The depression came rolling back. Big, black, and a mile high.
Should have killed yourself, guard. Shouldn't have waited.
Bobby's in trouble.
Well, maybe so, but getting help from a guy like you is like hiring a pyromaniac to fix the oil burner.
Shut up.
You're wasted, guard. Fried. Put that kid back there on the beach would undoubtedly call a burnout.
Mister, you sure you're all right? The girl asked. Her hair was red, cut punkily short. Her legs went approximately up to her chin.
Yeah, he said. Did I look not all right?
For a minute there, you looked terrible, she answered gravely. That made him grin. Not what she'd said, but the solemnity with which she'd said it, and she grinned back, relieved. He looked out the window and saw they were headed north on the main turnpike, only up to mile 36, so he couldn't have slept too long. The feathery mackerel scales of 2 hours ago were beginning to merge into a toneless gray that promised rain by afternoon. Before he got to Haven, it would probably be dark and he would be soaked. After hanging up the telephone at the mobile station, he had stripped off his socks and tossed them into the waste can on one of the gasoline islands. Then he walked over to Route 1 northbound in his bare feet and stood on the shoulder, old tote bag in one hand, the thumb of his other out and cocked north. 20 minutes later, this van had come along, a fairly new Dodge Caravelle with Delaware plate. A pair of electric guitars, their necks crossed like swords, were painted on the side along with the name of the group inside, the Eddie Parker Band. It pulled over, and Gardner had run to it, panting, tote bag banging his leg, headache pulsing white-hot pain into the left side of his head. In spite of the pain, he had been amused by the slogan carefully lettered across the van's doors, "If Eddie's rockin', don't come knockin'." Now, sitting on the floor and back, and reminding himself not to turn around quickly and thump the snare drum again, Gardner saw the Old Orchard exit coming up. At the same time, the first drops of rain hit the windshield. "Listen," Eddie said, pulling over. "I hate to leave you off like this. It's starting to rain and you don't even have any fucking shoes." "I'll be all right." "You don't look so all right," the girl in the cutoff said softly. Eddie whipped off his hat.
"Don't blame me, I voted for Howard the Duck," written over the visor, and said, "Cough up, you guys."
Wallets appeared. Change jingled in Jean's pocket.
"No. Hey, thanks, but no."
Gardner felt hot blood rush into his cheeks and burn there. Not embarrassment, but outright shame. Somewhere inside him he felt a strong, painful thud. It didn't rattle his teeth or bones. It was, he thought, his soul taking some final fall. It sounded melodramatic as hell. As for how it felt, well, it just felt real. That was the horrible part about it, just real.
"Okay,"
he thought.
"That's what it feels like. All your life you've heard people talk about hitting bottom. This is what it feels like. Here it is. James Eric Gardner, who was going to be the Ezra Pound of his generation, taking spare change from a Delaware bar band."
"Really? No." Eddie Parker went on passing the hat just the same. There was a bunch of change and a few $1 bills in it. Beaver got the hat last. He tossed in a couple of quarters.
"Look," Gardner said, "I appreciate it, but..." "Come on, Beaver," Eddie said. "Cough up, you fucking Scrooge. Really, I have friends in Portland. I'll just call a few up. And I think I might have left my checkbook with this one guy I know in Thelmet."
Gardner added wildly, "Beaver's a Scrooge." The girl in the cutoffs began to chant gleefully, "Beaver's a Scrooge, Beaver's a Scrooge." The others picked it up until Beaver, laughing and rolling his eyes, added another quarter and a New York lottery ticket.
"There, I'm tapped," he said, "unless you want to wait around for the brooms to work."
The guys in the band and the girl in the cutoffs were laughing wildly again, looking resignedly at Gardner as if to say, "You see the morons I have to deal with. You dig it?" Beaver handed the hat to Gardner, who had to take it. If he hadn't, the change would have rolled all over the van floor.
"Really," he said, trying to give the hat back to Beaver, "I'm perfectly okay."
"You ain't," Eddie Parker said. "So cut the bullshit. What do you say?"
"I guess I say thanks. That's all I can think of right now."
Well, it ain't so much you'll have to declare it on your income taxes, Eddie said, but it'll buy you some burgers and a pair of those rubber sandals.
The girl slid open the door in the caravel's sidewall. Get better, understand? She said.
Then, before he could reply, she hugged him and gave him a kiss, her mouth moist, friendly, half-open, and redolent of pot.
Take care, big guy.
I'll try.
On the verge of getting out, he suddenly hugged her again, fiercely.
Thank you. Thank you all.
He stood at the end of the ramp, the rain falling a little harder now, watching as the van's sidewall door rumbled shut on its track. The girl waved.
Gardner waved back, and then the van was rolling down the breakdown lane, gathering speed, finally sliding over into the travel lane.
Gardner watched them go, one hand still raised in a wave in case they might be looking back. Tears were running freely down his cheeks now, to mix with the rain. 3. He never did get a chance to buy a pair of rubber sandals, but he got to Haven before dark, and he didn't have to walk the last 10 or so miles to Bobby's house as he'd thought he might. You'd think people would be more apt to pick up a guy hitching in the rain, but that was just when they were most likely to pass you by, who needed a human puddle in the passenger seat. But he got a ride outside of Augusta with a farmer who complained constantly and bitterly about the government, all the way up to the Chinatown line, where he let Guard out. Guard walked a couple of miles, thumbing the few cars that passed, wondering if his feet were turning to ice or if it was just his imagination, when a pulp truck pulled to a rackety halt beside him. Gardner climbed into the cab as fast as he could. It smelled of old wood chips and sour lager sweat, but it was warm.
Thanks, he said.
Don't mention it, the driver said. Name's Freeman Moss.
He stuck out a hand. Gardner, who had no idea that he would meet this man in the not-too-distant future under far less cheery circumstances, took it and shook it.
Jim Gardner. Thanks again.
Shoot a pickle.
Freeman Moss scoffed. He got the truck moving. It shuddered along the edge of the road, picking up speed, Guard thought, not just grudgingly, but with actual pain. Everything shook. The Universal moaned beneath them like a hag in a chimney corner, the world's oldest toothbrush, its eroded bristles dark with the grease it had been employed to coax out of some clotted gear or cog tooth, chittered along the dashboard, passing an old air freshener of a naked woman with very large breasts on its way. Moss punched the clutch, managed to find second after an endless time spent grinding gears, and wrestled the pulp truck back onto the road.
You look half drowned. Got half a thermos of coffee from the Dunkin' Donuts in Augusta left over for my dinner. You want it?
Gardner drank it gratefully. It was strong, hot, and heavily laced with sugar. He also accepted a cigarette from the driver, dragging deeply and with pleasure, although it hurt his throat, which was getting steadily sorer. Moss dropped him off just over the Haventown line at 6:45. The rain had slacked off, and the sky was lightening up in the west.
"Do believe God's gonna let through some sunset," Freeman Moss said. "I wish like hell I had a pair of shoes I could give you, mister. I usually carry an old pair behind the seat, but it was so rainy today I never brought nothing but my gum rubbers."
"Thanks, but I'll be fine. My friend is less than a mile up the road."
Actually, Bobby's place was still 3 miles away, but if he told Moss that, nothing would do but that he'd drive Gardner up there. Gardner was tired, increasingly feverish, still damp even after 45 minutes of the heater's dry blasting air, but he couldn't stand any more kindness today. In his present state of mind, it could well drive him crazy.
Okay. Good luck.
Thank you.
He got down and waved as the truck turned off on a side road and rumbled away toward home. Even after Moss and his museum piece of a truck had disappeared, Gardner stood where he was for a moment longer, his wet tote bag in one hand, his bare feet, white as Easter lilies, planted in the dirt of the soft shoulder, looking at the marker some 200 feet back the way he had come. Home is the place where, when you have to go there, they have to take you in, Frost had said. But he'd do well to remember he wasn't home. Maybe the worst mistake a man could make was to get to the idea that his friend's home was his own, especially when the friend was a woman whose bed you had once shared. Not home. Not at all, but he was in Haven. He started to walk up the road toward Bobby's house.
4.
About 15 minutes later, when the clouds in the west finally broke open to let through the westering sun, something strange happened. A burst of music, clear and brief, went through his head. He stopped, looking at the sunlight as it spilled across rolling miles of wet woods and hayfields in the west, the rays beaming down like the dramatic sun rays in a DeMille Bible epic. Route 9 began to rise here, and the western view was long and gorgeous and solemn, the evening's light somehow English and pastoral in its clear beauty. The rain had given the landscape a sleek, washed look, deepening colors seeming to fulfill the texture of things. Gardner was suddenly very glad he had not committed suicide, not in any corny Art Linkletter way, but because he had been allowed this moment of beauty and perceptual glow. Standing here, now almost at the end of his energy, feverish and sick, he felt a child's simple wonder. All was still and silent in the final sunshine of evening. He could see no sign of industry or technology. Humanity, yes. A big red barn attached to a white farmhouse. Sheds. A trailer or two. But that was all. The light. It was the light that struck him so strongly. Its sweet clarity, so old and deep. Those rays of sun slanting almost horizontally through the unraveling clouds as this long, confusing, exhausting day neared its end. That ancient light seemed to deny time itself, and Gardner almost expected to hear a huntsman winding his horn, announcing all assemble. He would hear dogs and horses' hooves, and that was when the music, jarring and modern, blasted through his head, scattering all thought. His hands flew to his temples in a startled gesture. The burst lasted at least 5 seconds, perhaps as long as 10, and what he heard was perfectly identifiable. It was Dr. Hook singing Baby Makes Her Blue Jeans Talk. The lyric was tinny, but clear enough, as if he were listening to a small transistor radio, the kind that people used to take to the beach with them before that punk rock group Walkman and the Ghetto Blasters had taken over the world. But it wasn't pouring into his ears, that lyric. It was coming from the front of his head, from the place where the doctors had filled a hole in his skull with a piece of metal. The queen of all the nightbirds, a player in the dark. She don't say nothing, but baby makes her blue jeans talk. The volume was so loud it was almost unbearable. It had happened once before, this music in his head, after he'd stuck his finger into a light socket. And was he drunk at the time? My dear, does a dog piss on a fireplug? He had discovered such musical visitations were neither hallucinatory nor all that rare. People had gotten radio transmissions on the lawn flamingos in their yards, on teeth fillings, on the steel rims of their spectacles. For a week and a half in 1957, a family in Charlotte, North Carolina, had received signals from a classical music station in Florida. They first heard them coming from the bathroom water glass. Soon, other glasses in the house began to pick up the sound. Before it ended, the whole house was filled with the eerie sound of glassware broadcasting Bach and Beethoven, the music broken only by an occasional time check. Finally, with a dozen violins holding one long high note, almost all the glasses in the house shattered spontaneously and the phenomenon ceased. So Gardner had known he wasn't alone, and had been sure he wasn't going crazy, but that wasn't much comfort, and never had been as loud as this after the light socket incident. The sound of Dr. Hook faded as quickly as it had come. Gardner stood tensely, waiting for it to come back. It didn't. What came instead, louder and more urgent than before, was a repetition of what had gotten him going in the first place.
Bobby's in trouble.
He turned away from the western view and started up Route 9 again, and although he was feverish and very tired, he walked fast. In fact, before long he was almost running. 5. It was 7:30 when Gardner finally arrived at Bobby's, what the locals still called the old Garrick place, even after all these years. Gardner came swinging up the road, puffing, his color high and unhealthy. Here was the rural free delivery box, its door slightly ajar, the way both Bobby and Joe Paulson, the mailman, left it, so it would be easier for Peter to paw open. There was the driveway, with Bobby's blue pickup truck parked in it. The stuff in the truck bed had been covered with a tarp to protect it from the rain. And there was the house itself, with a light shining through the east window, the one where Bobby kept her rocker and did her reading. Everything looked all right. Not a single sour note. 5 years ago, even three, Peter would have barked at the arrival of a stranger outside, but Peter had gotten older. Hell, they all had. Standing out here, Bobby's place held the sort of quiet, pastoral loveliness that the western view at the town line had held for him. It represented all the things Gardner wished he had for himself. A sense of peace, or maybe just a sense of place. Certainly he could see nothing odd as he stood here by the mailbox. It looked, felt, like the house of a person who is content with herself. Not completely at rest, exactly, or retired, or checked out from the world's concerns, but rocking steady. This was the house of a sane, relatively happy woman. It had not been built in the tornado belt. All the same, something was wrong. He stood there, the stranger out here in the dark.
But I'm not a stranger, I'm a friend, her friend, Bobby's friend, aren't I?
And a sudden frightening impulse rose within him. To leave. Just turn on one bare heel and bug out, because he suddenly doubted if he wanted to find out what was going on inside that house. What kind of trouble Bobby had gotten herself into.
Tommyknocker's guard, that's what kind, Tommyknockers.
He shivered.
Late last night and the night before, Tommyknockers at Bobby's door, and I don't know if you can...
Stop it!
Because guard's so afraid of the Tommyknocker man.
He licked his lips, trying to tell himself it was just the fever that made them feel so dry.
Get out, guard. Blood on the moon.
The fear was now very deep indeed, and if it had been anyone but Bobby... Anyone but his last real friend, he would have split all right. The farmhouse looked rustic and pleasant. The light spilling from the east window was cozy and all looked well. But the boards and the glass, the stones in the driveway, the very air pressing against his face, all these things screamed at him to leave, get out. The things inside that house were bad, dangerous, perhaps even evil.
Tommyknockers.
But whatever else was in there, Bobby was too. He hadn't come all these miles, most in the pouring rain, to turn and run at the last second. So, in spite of the dread, he left the mailbox and started up the driveway, moving slowly, wincing as the sharp stones dug at the tender soles of his feet. Then the front door jerked open, startling his heart up into his throat in a single nimble bound, and he thought,
"It's one of them, one of the Tommyknockers. It's going to rush down here and grab me and eat me up."
He was barely able to stifle a scream. The silhouette in the doorway was thin, much too thin, he thought, to be Bobby Anderson, who had never been beefy, but who was solidly built and pleasantly round in all the right places. But the voice, shrill and wavering though it was unmistakably Bobby. And Gardner relaxed a little, because Bobby sounded even more terrified than he felt, standing by the mailbox and looking at the house. "Who is it? Who's there?" "It's guard, Bobby." There was a long pause. There were footfalls on the porch. Cautiously. "Guard? Is it really you?"
"Yeah."
He worked his way over the hard-biting stones of the driveway to the lawn. And he asked the question he had come all this way and deferred his own suicide to ask.
"Bobby, are you all right?"
The quaver left Bobby's voice. But Gardner could still not see her clearly. The sun had long since gone behind the trees, and the shadows were thick. He wondered where Peter was.
"I'm fine," Bobby said, just as if she had always looked so terribly thin,
just as though she had always greeted arrivals in her dooryard with a shrill voice full of fear. She came down the porch steps and passed out of the shadow of the overhanging porch roof. As she did, Gardner got his first good look at her in the ashy twilight. He was struck by horror and wonder.